From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from the programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. Are you getting ready for college, or do you know someone who's sweating over acceptance letters, wondering where to attend? Or maybe you're getting ready to graduate from college and wondering how to pay the inevitable student loan bills.
When I signed my promissory note, I was 17 and a half. I was very naive with regards to my expectations.
That's our cover story, a check-in on student loans and the students who struggle to pay them. Then, look out, they're coming. Cicadas are on their way back to terrorize our neighborhoods. And wait, there's more. Stink bugs are also on the rise, which might make you turn to booze and leave you asking, how do you get red wine stains off a baby? That's what comedian Kelly Oxford asked her Twitter followers. She's got a book out called Everything is Perfect When You're a Liar, and you can't argue with that. Then we check out a photo exhibit on the Big Cypress Seminole Reservation in southwestern Florida that's shedding new light on old family stories.
We do have people coming in and they recognize maybe a great-grandmother, that kind of thing.
And finally, the music of New Zealander Jin Wigmore. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
The street, a liar, I'm gonna lure you into the dark. My cold desire to hear the boom, boom, boom of your heart. The danger is I'm dangerous and I might just tear you apart. Oh.
On a sunny Friday morning, students at the University of Maryland are headed to class. Next month, the class of 2013 will graduate. These are a group of students who enrolled in college after the crash of 2008. So, how have they paid for it?
I'm paying completely with student loans.
Pretty much all of my tuition is being paid with student loans right now.
Yes, I have a lot of student loans.
And here's Sierra Klinkscales, a senior.
I had to take out $19,000 for my freshman year, and I've taken out at least $6,000 a semester since then. I'm in debt.
And they're not the only ones. 37 million Americans share about $1 trillion in student loans. It's the biggest consumer debt besides mortgages. It eclipses both auto loans and credit cards. And on it grows, an appetite undiminished by the recession. And that's today's cover story, student loans. Coping, recovering, and rethinking.
My name is Emmanuel Tejas. I am a legal assistant, administrative assistant at a Boston law school.
We spoke to Tejas a year ago, and we checked back in with him this week. He graduated in 2008 from Northeastern University in Boston, where he majored in English. On graduation day, he owed about $50,000. But Tejas defaulted on his loans after getting laid off. And today, his debt has ballooned to more than $70,000, thanks to interest and collections fees. Tejas says he got lost in what he calls the labyrinth of his private loans.
So I became very angry and unwisely and hot-headedly decided I was not going to pay until I understood the full extent of the debt that I owed.
Tejas hired a lawyer to help him navigate that labyrinth. He's now consolidated his federal loans, and he's chipping away at the total. He pays about $500 a month. He says it just wasn't a responsibility he was ready for when he applied to college.
When I signed my promissory note, I was 17 and a half. I was very naive with regards to my expectations. I knew early on that I wasn't going to be living high off the hog being an English major. I didn't know the explicit terms, the fact that you cannot discharge this debt in bankruptcy, the fact that your wages could be garnished by the federal government if you were to default. There would have been something that, had I known, I probably would have been more circumspect in what kind of loans I would have taken out.
In other words, Emmanuel Tejas admits he made a serious mistake, and he hopes future students, including his own sister, can learn from his struggles.
You know, I tell my sister, who is now at UC Berkeley, to be far more frugal than she imagines she has to be. One thing that I kind of had to learn the hard way is scan all the documents you get and make sure that you have electronic copies because, you know, people move, young people move a lot. We're very mobile.
Today, Tejas is actually back in school, pursuing a part-time master's in public administration. This time, he says, lessons are learned. He's not borrowing. Instead, his employer is picking up the tab. When we talked to Emmanuel Tejas last year, the interest rate for some federal student loans was about to double, from 3.4% to nearly 7%. But in the spring of 2012, there was a lot going on. The Occupy movement had put the issue of student debt at the forefront, and it was an election year. So Congress delayed that interest rate bump until this July. So the issue is here again. Representative Karen Bass, a Democrat from California, is hoping to end the debate for good. Her proposal is to cap interest rates at 3.4%. It's all part of a package she hopes will alleviate the burden.
The Student Loan Fairness Act would do several things. It would permanently cap the interest rates at 3.4%. It would also say that a student who graduates college and pays their loan back for 10 straight years, after that, their loan would be forgiven. Now, of course, there's a cap to this, too, which means we are talking about debt that would not be beyond $45,000. So if you pay your loans back for 10 years, if you have anything left, then the federal government would forgive it.
So the government would forgive up to $45,000 per graduate. Now, that is a lot of money. So how do you square this with the sequester and the circumstances under which we live now?
Well, you know, there are a lot of problems that we're facing in our country. We really need to rethink how higher education is paid for, period. But until then, we really shouldn't pass this debt on to future generations. And everybody understands that if we want to have a society, number one, that is competitive with other countries, we have got to invest in the future. We have got to invest in our youth, and the number one way to do that is education.
So if the government's willing to cover much of the difference after a certain point, after, say, a decade worth of paying a loan back, what's to stop tuition costs from continuing to skyrocket?
Well, first of all, it is only up to $45,000. But we also have to put pressure on every part of society. So there is the pressure that needs to be put on Congress. There's also the pressure that needs to be put on colleges, too. We need to examine what the cost of tuition is. The idea that you could go to a four-year university, and for me, you know, who is older, I certainly remember going to college and could never imagine being in as much debt as it would take to purchase a home. And that's what many of our young people are faced with now.
California Democrat Karen Bass. Most of 2013's graduates won't have quite that kind of house-sized debt. The average for borrowers is more like $25,000. But remember, student loan debt is still growing. And outside of mortgages, it's the biggest consumer debt. Planet Money's Zoe Chase says we should look at the growing debt in another way.
It means a lot more students are going to college. That's the main reason it's going up so much. Student debt per student is getting bigger too, but the main reason that you see student debt getting so big is because more and more people are going to college.
Zoe, should we be worried about these debt-burdened students, graduates now, being a drag on the entire economy? And if they're leaving schools thousands of dollars in the hole, but perhaps they're not spending much on buying cars, clothes, all the other things that power the economy?
Yes. On the one hand, if you have a ton of debt to pay back, if you have loans, you are not going to be spending as much money. But it's wrong to kind of compare the student that's really in debt with college loans to the student without. So the student without college debt, obviously, they have a lot more spending power. That's great. But what you have to do is you have to compare the student with student loans to the student that never went to college at all. That is a drag on the economy, for sure. They're just sort of locked out of the labor force. They fall into the social safety net. That's a worse problem to worry about. So you definitely see people with student loans, you know, not buying houses, not necessarily buying cars. And that's an issue. But I would say the thing to worry about more is when you have students going to college and not finishing, because that is just obviously a bad investment. You have a ton of debt and you don't really have the power to pay it back.
Zoe, what about those people with $100,000 loans and a degree in something like, say, sociology?
I do feel worried about those people. I know some of those people. But the thing is, that's a really, really small percentage of people. And there are ways to refinance the debt that you have if you have something like $100,000. But again, if they had left school before getting that sociology degree, that would be a way worse situation.
Planet Money's Zoe Chase. Long before the recession started, students had few worries about all this borrowing.
I considered loans to be another financial aid. My belief at that point was if I get a first degree or a bachelor's degree, I can be able to repay those loans without any issue.
That's Dawit Lema. He graduated in 2004 from UMass Boston, where he supplemented his work-study income with student loans. Now, he's a financial aid counselor at the University of Maryland, where he sees a different kind of student borrower, one much more wary than he was.
They know more about the loan process, so they want to know about not just interest rate, they just want to know about repayment options, consolidations, forgiveness options. Those are questions I never asked when I was in school.
Are there any red flags for you as a financial aid counselor when a student comes to you?
When a student comes to me, a red flag probably will be someone who is looking for a huge amount of private loans, alternative loans, using loans for other than educational expenses, like buying a car that has reduced drastically. But a student who would like to get more than our cost of attendance, we take that student seriously and counsel them about financial options, the federal loan program, and compare the two and give them all the options before they make the decision.
So how much money in loans does the average student at the University of Maryland leave college owing?
I believe, according to the federal government data, it's a little bit more than $17,000 on average for undergraduate students.
It must be a burden, however, for a young person to start life with a $17,000 to $23,000 debt in this economy. I realize that 17 is your average. How are the students you talk to every day dealing with this?
It's tough. Definitely, if you have a high loan amount like $17,000, and if you're graduating and what you're hearing around you is the job perspectives are not that bright, it's a depressing issue. But absolutely, most of the students I deal with have a bright outlook. They're almost 100% certain they'll go out and compete and secure a position that will pay them to pay back these loans.
Dawit Lema of the University of Maryland. 100% might be stretching it, but back out on McKeldin Mall at UMD, students Van Holmes and Eric Medlin reveal the kind of pragmatism that their financial aid counselor says he's seeing.
Especially with the career I chose, I should get a job right out of college, so it shouldn't really be a problem. I should start making my money pretty soon.
I did go to a community college and then transfer over here, so save some money, so I knew I would have enough.
A generation that's much more cautious and still calculating that a diploma is an essential thing to have. But you need to calculate also how to pay for it. That's Diploma Reality Check 101. Spring is here, and just as temperatures begin to creep up, so do the bugs, all matter of creepy crawlies, among the noisiest and, for my money, most repulsive cicadas.
My name is Michael J. Raup. I'm professor of entomology and the bug guy here at the University of Maryland College Park.
Raup is lucky for a guy who makes bugs his business. He's living in the heart of what people in his world consider insect Super Bowl. Now, I don't normally think of myself as a squeamish type, really, but maybe you're okay with shoveling dead cicadas in the backyard by the wheelbarrow. If not, and you live on the East Coast, then look out, for a teeming horde is on its way.
This one's going to be absolutely spectacular. This one's going to go all the way from northern North Carolina up to the Hudson Valley in New York.
They're known as the Brood 2 cicadas, and they've been developing underground for 17 years.
I've seen estimates as high as a billion cicadas per square mile. This is really going to rock some people's world.
Like mine. But Ralph says there's really nothing to fear.
Understand that they're not going to hurt you or your children or your pets. They're not going to breed in your house.
And cicadas actually do a lot of good, like aerating the soil and providing a good meal.
In about 6 weeks, when these guys make the big break for it, the birds are simply going to go nuts. Everything on the planet is going to want to eat a cicada. And historically, we know that Native Americans considered the cicada emergence a huge bounty because there was just simply so much protein out there.
There are about 18 broods of periodical cicadas, those that live for 13 or 17 years underground. Those aren't to be confused with the annual cicadas, which appear later on in the summer. Rapp says gardeners have already begun to uncover the brood 2 nymphs in the soil. And once the soil hits the 64-degree mark, things will really start to heat up.
They'll build their escape chimneys from their subterranean crypts. So underneath trees, we'll begin to see holes about the size of a dime, and in some cases, little mud tubes that might extend an inch or two above the surface of the soil.
Oh, how exciting. Then the nymphs will shed their skins, climb a tree, and then amorous males make music.
The sound is all about love. It's about romance. They make this noise with an organ called the timbal, which is like a drum head. Just beneath their wings, they vibrate this. Now, there'll be three different songs that the male uses to attract his mate. The first is something like, "Hey, I think I've seen you here before." The second one is, "Wow, that's a really pretty outfit you have on." And the third one is something like, "You want to come back to my place and look at the etchings?"
They only get to live and love a few weeks above ground. Around late June, their siren songs sort of peter out, and so will the cicadas. But we can look forward to meeting and hearing the next generation in 2030. But wait, there's more. Here's another horror, friends. Stink bugs. I once had one crawl in my ear while I was sleeping.
Officially, they have been detected in 40 states and the District of Columbia, as well as Ontario, Canada.
That's Tracy Leske.
I'm a research entomologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And her specialty is stink bugs.
This insect is commonly referred to as brown marmorated stink bug. The scientific name is Haliomorpha halis, and this is an invasive species. It's actually native to China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan.
The stink bug came over to the U.S. in the late 1990s, probably aboard a shipment from China.
These are large, conspicuous bugs. If you look at it from above, they look similar in shape to a shield. Now, the name marmorated means marbled, and that's based on the appearance of the black and white pattern that you see on the sides of their abdomen. They also have stripes on their antennae that are pretty conspicuous. They're pretty big, and because they're stink bugs, they have what we call piercing, sucking mouth parts, which is basically like a straw that they insert into plants to feed on the juices.
That's right, only plant juices. No need to worry about those piercing, sucking mouth parts finding an arm or a leg. But yeah, they can be a household gross out for most people.
Especially, you know, when they find one poised on their toothbrush, that sort of thing.
But to farmers, brown marmorated stink bugs are destructive. That's how Leske and the USDA got involved with the bugs. Farmers were worried about the impact on crops. These stink bugs will eat almost any crops, especially fruit like apples and peaches.
They insert their mouth parts through the skin of the fruit and then suck up the juices, so leaving behind these dry, corky areas just beneath the skin, and oftentimes it collapses, so you see these depressions on the surface of the fruit as well.
Right now, Leske and the USDA are working out ways to control the spread of stink bugs, and one method they're trying is fighting bugs with other insects.
This is something that actually recognizes stink bug eggs as a really good meal. It is a very tiny wasp, and so these wasps are in quarantine in Newark, Delaware, where they are being screened for their capacity to choose brown marmorated stink bug over our native stink bug species.
It's a risky strategy. What if the wasps go rogue? So stink bug researchers are really taking their time before they release any tiny wasp predators. Unfortunately, there will be no miracle cure on the line for this summer. It looks like it's going to be an especially stink buggy one.
We have started to see a little bit of activity here in our own building. I have quite a few walking around my office. I think they actually are taunting me at this point.
With all these creepy, crawly bugs on the way, I think it's about time to book a summer vacation to, say, Antarctica. Any place but here. For some years now, I've spent a little time each spring in the Florida Everglades. Even inside the Everglades, there's nothing quite as evocative as the Florida of mangrove swamps and inhospitable terrain that you find on the Seminole territories, where, at a place like Big Cypress Reservation in southwest Florida, you can still get a sense of what it was like a century ago. For one thing, not a road existed then between the east and west coasts.
This is it. This was the frontier, the final frontier.
Willie Johns is a member of the Panther Clan of the Cow Creek Seminole people. He's also outreach coordinator for the Ahtatiki Museum on the Big Cypress Reservation in southern Florida. This year, Ahtatiki is hosting an archive of photographs from an early 20th century expedition, glass plate box camera photos of everyday life that were previously unknown.
This is a wagon, and it's full of supplies. And just down miles from here is Brown's Trading Post, and that's where they're headed.
The photographs have been provided by curators at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, who'd preserved them since they were donated by the photographer in the 1920s.
All of these images were taken by Julian Dimmick on a particular expedition in 1910.
Rebecca Fell is the exhibits coordinator at Ahtatiki. She and everyone else at the museum was surprised to learn of the existence of these photographs.
The American Museum of Natural History did not for a long time realized what they had. And when the archives got switched over from one department to another, they started going through it and like, oh.
Oh, indeed. In the early 1900s, Julian Dimmock and his father, A.W., decided to travel through Florida to document the Seminole Indians. This was only 50 years after the last Seminole War, when the Seminoles fought against forced removal by the U.S. government.
This is a period of history that there isn't a whole lot of information. And so these images actually give a great snapshot of how Seminoles, particularly Miccosukee Seminoles, were living in the Everglades.
The photographs at Ahtatiki give us a roughly west-to-east journey across the Everglades. Willie Johns points out to me one of his favorite photos of three men waiting next to a covered wagon pulled through a swamp by a team of oxen.
And they're coming from Fort Myers, going back to the settlement over here at Brown's Landing.
And what are they walking in? It looks like they're walking in a
They're walking in water about ankle deep. This is a tall man, so you can see that. It's very wet period.
They're barefoot, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, oh boy, it looks dangerous. There must have been snakes in that water.
Oh yeah, alligators, you know, and all the subtropical species out there that'll eat you, you know.
Is this the way that, besides canoe, that people got around? There weren't any roads, right?
Yeah, this is it.
The difficulty of getting these shots was extraordinary. Expedition members wrote of their skin being scored by insect bites, and Julian often had to stand in the swamp to get a shot. Here's curator Rebecca Fell.
Julian Dimmick had a big box camera on a tripod, and he used glass lantern slides for the negatives. So he obviously had to take the moment to set everything up, often standing in the water as well. And then to have all these glass lanterns to make it all the way back to New York. Just that whole process, you know, wasn't straightforward. Nowadays, we pull out our cell phone and take a real quick shot. This was truly a process to obtain these images.
But until these photos were made available to the tribe, few modern-day Seminoles had ever actually seen their ancestors' faces, as Willie Johns himself realized.
You know how you hear about your relative and you never put a face to them, you know, mm-hmm. but you've always heard about them. And then all of a sudden, here's Wilson Cypress, who's a great uncle to one of my niece's husband, and he's named after him. So he got to see the features, and they all look alike, you know, all the Cypress guys.
We do have people coming in, and they recognize maybe a great-grandmother, that kind of thing.
One striking portrait subject looks like she could be a great-grandmother. Again, Rebecca Fell.
This is the widow of Tiger Tail, and he was one of the important leaders of the Second Seminole War. Her features, she's clearly lived a long and interesting life.
Tiger Tail's widow looks weathered and yet strong. And Willie Johns agrees she'd have to be.
All she's known is war. Second Seminole, the Third, the Civil War, all on down.
Not just the Seminole Wars of resistance against the U.S. government, but their ultimate forced removal, a common story for American Indians in the 19th century.
Except ours wasn't the Trail of Tears. Ours was to the fort, to the ship, then you went straight to New Orleans, put on a steamer there, and ship right into Arkansas.
Some of the photos are stunning portraits. Some are costume photos of everyday life.
You see a family here in the dugout canoe. And this was a real typical travel in this area because, you know, this is the headwaters of the Everglades. So it always stayed wet. And you could use these things, these canoes.
See a man standing here in traditional dress, and beside him is a woman. There's probably, it says here that this is George Osceola, his wife Ruby. Seminole women wore elaborately coiffed hair and full-length patchwork dresses. Men wore billowing tunics, belts, and feathered hats. The ultra-bright Florida sun brings out gray tones so intense you can almost see the true colors.
Even though we know they're wearing some of their best clothes in a lot of these pictures, you still see them doing what they do on a daily basis. But it says a lot about the lifestyle and what's going on at that time.
Not long after the trip, Julian Dimock gave up photography, and the photographs went into storage. They'll be up for the rest of the year at the Ahtahtiki Museum in Big Cypress, Florida, where Seminoles and the rest of the public can connect with history. To see some of these photographs without leaving home, visit our webpage, npr.org, and click on the Picture Show blog. Kelly Oxford is a little bit wicked and a whole lot wild and funny. In no time, she went from being a housewife and mother of three in Calgary to internet fame through her blog and later through Twitter, where her popularity exploded. There, she shared zips like, "How do you get red wine stains off a baby?" and "If you can name five Kardashians but can't name five countries in Asia, stick a knife in an electrical socket." She's been retweeted by Jimmy Kimmel, John Mayer, and even the late Roger Ebert, one of her earliest supporters. Kelly Oxford's first book is called Everything is Perfect When You're a Liar. Now, it's not a collection of tweets. It is a series of outrageous vignettes about her life so far. But she does accommodate her Twitter fans with a list of things she'd like people to do for her at her funeral.
1. Stuff my bra for me. 2. Play the Game Over theme from Super Mario Brothers.
Far from a funeral, Kelly Oxford's rebirth as a writer is taking off in a big way.
Play the videos of North Koreans crying for Kim Jong-il and pretend it's for me.
All right, I'm going to write my own tweet here. Kelly Oxford on Weekend All Things Considered has new book, movie, TV pilot, lives in L.A. now. Hashtag don't hate her. Kelly Oxford, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you've got this great new memoir out. I'm wondering about the title of the book. It's called Everything is Perfect When You're a Liar, because you make it clear in these stories that you're a terrible liar.
I'm a terrible liar. I really believe that the only way that anybody can have a seemingly perfect life is if they're covering up a lot of their life and they're lying to everyone and perhaps sometimes themselves. So that's where the title came from.
Well, what's wonderful in this book is that you have this gumption to tell the truth to those in authority, even from a really early age.
Right. Well, I just found it was more fun to tell the truth and get a reaction than to say what everybody was expecting me to say from a very early age.
Your Twitter fame starts to pay off when you discover that David Copperfield is a fan of yours. And you parlay that into this free room and a free show in Las Vegas. And I love the way you describe meeting Copperfield. You say he's tall and he's broad-shouldered and he has these beautiful bedroom eyes of Osama bin Laden. How was the magic close-up?
The magic was insane. He put me right at the front of the stage. I was just thinking, there's no way they're going to be able to pull off these illusions where they can mess up. I mean, I was right up against the stage. And then he did this one illusion that still to this day, like I would love to watch it over and over and over and just analyze it, because he laid down in one of those, you know, magician-like coffin boxes, and from both ends of the box, it was spinning around so I could see underneath of it. And there was one person on each end pushing the box in. So his body was shrinking. So his head was getting closer to his feet. And they were getting closer and closer and closer and closer until it was the smallest box with just his head sticking out of one end and his feet looking like they were coming out of his neck. And at that point, I was like, oh, my God, I just met this guy like 30 minutes ago and he was totally normal. And I'm going to have to hang out with him in like another 15 minutes after seeing this. Like, it was just, it was such a surreal moment seeing that and wondering how he could be possibly doing that. So,
but I love that you had this absolutely stage side seat to an experience, seeing a man shrink into something almost like, I had in my mind, a shoebox spinning around and around.
Yes.
I thought, this is like a dream, or maybe it's like the end of a really bad work day.
That's right.
Kelly, talk to me about honing your craft. You're in your mid-30s. You had your first baby when you were 23. At that time, you were only kind of erratically, although it was fun, working in TV and film projects in Canada. But you have known what you wanted to do seemingly since your lungs first filled with air.
Yeah. I think that I was, you know, when my mom told me what the internet was, I think in 1993, and I was in high school, and I just instantly knew that this was a place that I could put out material. And, you know, even though I didn't really recognize it, the audience that I did have online, which was, you know, a little under 10,000 people would get emails when I would blog through all of this. Mm-hmm. I was using them, you know, as a sounding board, telling me what they liked, what they didn't like. So, you know, a good analogy, I guess, for that would be the stand-up comic, you know, that right. gets on stage and tries out new jokes. Oh, this works. This didn't work. I don't think a lot of writers that publish books or write movies get an opportunity to use an audience to their benefit. And somehow I managed to do that this entire time.
You were interactive before you even really heard a whole lot about that. You know, there are millions and millions of tweeters out there, and it's really tough to cut through the noise. When did you start to realize that what you were doing was actually connecting with people?
Really, really early on. I joined in March of 2009, and by the end of that summer, I had, you know, comedians following me. And by the following spring, I had a very large following of people in entertainment following me. And I had been invited down to Los Angeles to be a part of a night of 140 tweets, which was a benefit for Haiti. Mm-hmm. It was 140 celebrities reading one tweet. And I was the only non-stand-up comedian or actor or, you know, working writer that was there.
Boy, you have to tell me your tweet.
Oh, my God. I don't even remember what it was. Let me think. It was, I always watch Law and Order because I think my future attacker is watching it, too, and I want to be a step ahead of them.
I do think your tweets are absolutely sensational. I don't know. I just love how you get red wine stains off a baby.
Right. The simpler they are, the better they hit.
Do you think that women have a certain permission to really be funny now? I mean, when Dorothy Parker was writing, you know, it was almost considered shocking at what a quipster she was.
Yeah. You know, since Bridesmaids came out, I think that a lot of things have changed for women in comedy. Same with girls on HBO. I mean, in Bridesmaids, we saw women getting sick, and we've never seen that in a film before. And I think that was a really big turning point. And for that movie to do so well at the box office, I think has really opened a lot of doors for female comedians because, you know, now the big bosses and the businessmen can say, oh, people actually will pay to see women be funny and crazy and in crazy situations.
Yeah. When you started with Twitter, did you have these kinds of expectations? Did you seriously think, wow, this is my ticket?
No. Never. I mean, look, I've been online since 1993, and I would brag to people about having 7,000 people getting an email about a blog that I'd written, you know, and this was in 2001. I had no idea. And it wasn't a goal for any of this to happen. I was a very happy homemaker with, you know, two kids and eventually three. And I was just so satisfied having an audience. And, you know, to me, having just under 10,000 people interested in me online pre-Facebook was just such a huge success to me that I would still, if I was in that position, would just be sailing right along at home, you know, making pasta and picking up my husband at the train station every day.
That's humor writer Kelly Oxford. Her first book is called Everything is Perfect When You're a Liar. And you can read an excerpt on her website, npr.org. Kelly Oxford, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Time now for music. Sometimes a background player on a movie or TV screen will command the attention of the viewer and force you to ask, who is that? That's what happened with Gin Wigmore's performance in a series of Heineken ads featuring actor Daniel Craig as, who else, James Bond, about to take a dive out of a high-speed train. Gin Wigmore was only on the screen for a fleeting moment, but the music that scored the chase scene absolutely stood out. And now, the New Zealand native, 26, has a full record for us here in the States. It's called Gravel and Wine, and Gin Wigmore joins us from our studios in Culver City. Gin, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's fantastic to be here.
You know, the song that they used in this kicky, just amazing ad that really hooked me in, it's called Man Like That. I want everybody to be able to hear it like we did, so let's take a closer listen.
I don't really want to wake you. I just came to get my things, but the pretty little thing lying there beside you better take off my wedding ring. Hey, girl, do you really want to do this? You don't know I'm just stepping in. He's got more that came from me, not so special in the end.
I've been listening to this for a couple of days in the car. And it's amazing I haven't got a ticket yet. It just reaches out and grabs you. You know, there are reviewers who say that you're basically telling men off in a lot of your lyrics, that there's revenge, twisted, gothic, lavish love. I mean, were you in some kind of vengeful state of mind? Because you're a really lovely person to talk to.
Yeah, I think. I change moods regularly. But I kind of like playing in this world of a little bit fantasy when I write music. I think writing music is such a freeing exercise, and it's really nice to play in that world of being this, you know, confident, vengeful kind of getting back at all the bad boyfriends and all these things. It's like the conversation that you didn't have that you thought of having 5 minutes later. You know, you break up and you say something pathetic, or you don't even speak at all when someone's telling you they don't love you anymore. But then you think about it 5 minutes later and you have all these great comebacks. And that's the cool thing about songwriting is, you know, you have that time to have perspective and look back and think about all the things you'd want to say that at the time you wish you had.
Gin, you're only 26, and you've been writing music for a really long time. I think your voice, too. I mean, everyone's going to have a different take on it, but I was thinking, I don't know, you know, sort of Eartha Kitt meets Willie Nelson. I mean, there's a snarl here, too, that certainly has retro soul. On this song, Black Sheep, you're almost snarling this delivery. Let's hear some of Black Sheep. So making my own road out of gravel and some wine. do you approach these knowing you're going to snarl in this delivery?
you have a sense of what it needs. When you write the lyrics, you kind of go, well, obviously I can't sing this really sweetly. If you're saying I have a pistol for a mouth, you don't want to be singing that like you've got sunshines and lollipops running through your mind. But it's, I think you've got an idea of how you want to deliver it, but then you've really got to think about artists that you like, how they deliver things and things like that when you're singing it. It's very important to have them at the front of your mind.
So who are you thinking about? Other artists that, you know, have come before that you're sort of channeling?
During this record, it's strangely enough, I mean, we listened to a lot of T-Rex, and there was that, especially for Black Sheep, we were listening to that and getting in that kind of glam, slightly snarly in that respect, but this kind of confidence to it. There's such a confidence to that in an I don't kind of care attitude that I think a lot of these songs required on this record. And I was also in the, if only, I was thinking in the world of Elvis quite a lot for Gravel and Wine, especially during the recording singing
process.
No one
snarled like he did.
Yeah, well, there we go.
My guest is Jen Wigmore. Her new album is called Gravel and Wine. You know, you mentioned Elvis, and you toured the South when you were younger, right?
Yes.
I know you went to Stax Records. Did you go to Graceland? Where else did you go?
I did.
Nashville.
I went to Sun Studios. I went to Graceland. I went to Clarksdale in Mississippi, which was my favorite. It was fantastic. It was really cool. It was Bessie Smith and Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson's kind of stomping ground back in the day. So it had all that kind of flavour down there, and being introduced to a juke joint for the first time and drinking this moonshine that I'd heard of in movies, you know, like it was really cool exploring all this. And
so when you were there, you walk in, there's just little, you're delicate, you're young, flowing blonde hair. Did you say, hey, I'm here in Clarksdale, Mississippi. I want to sing blues?
Yes, I did. I did exactly that. What a dork. I went into this juke joint. There's nothing. I think it's closed. It looked closed. It had junk all out the front. Looked pretty dero. But anyway, we went there and it was open. There were three dudes there and I bowl on in, as you say, pretty delicate at the time with flowing blonde hair. Say, and they're like, you know, they look at me pretty much up and down about 50 times and say, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm from New Zealand. I'm here to make a blues record. And they're like, oh,
you're
yeah, right, sure. Good luck with that. So it was pretty cool. It was a nice rude awakening, you know, really, that I knew nothing about the blues, and that if, you know, he quickly advised me that if I found myself from getting from New Zealand to Clarksdale, Mississippi, that I'd never have the blues because I could afford the plane ticket. So I really kind of was shocked by that. And also I had a total realization that I had no right being down there and making this blues record. But really I just wanted to gather all these ingredients and these stories and talk to these guys and get a little influence of it. And I think all those little influences found their way onto Gravel and Wine. You got it long.
You visited the Reverend Al Green's church in Memphis.
Yes,
a place
I've
always wanted to go. What was that like?
That was incredible. Oh my gosh. I drove down to the kind of outskirts of Memphis, driving along on Sunday morning. I think this is the first time I've been up on a Sunday before 12 midday. So that was a highlight in itself. And driving down there and I rocked in an old band t-shirt, which was not the thing to do because everyone was so beautifully dressed.
Oh yes, very beautifully dressed.
Yeah, and you know, Al Green comes out and says he's got a bit of a rusty voice this morning, yet he still nails it, sings every song, and it's this total celebration. And people are, you know, fainting, and there's white sheets being run out over people, and it was just totally eye-opening. And I walked out of there, and I was like, right, I'm converted. I'm totally religion. This is my thing. I'm going to church every Sunday. This is on. And then I kind of thought about it for about another 5 minutes and thought, well, it's never actually going to be like this ever again. And it means I have to get up at 10 a.m. every Sunday. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, that would make those Saturday night gigs difficult.
Yeah, Saturday, that would draw that right out. I got the devil's disease.
And that's Jen Wigmore. Her latest album is called Gravel and Wine, and you can watch a few of her new videos at nprmusic.org. Congrats and good luck.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely to talk to you.
For the week ending April 7th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Becky Sullivan, and Acacia Squires, with help this week from Marlene Davis and Andrew Fishman. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. The technical director is Rob Berman. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend, and we'll be broadcasting from our bright and shiny new DC headquarters. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.